On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Today we've got a special treat for you. These are some shorter interviews that I did over the last couple of months that they might air on the morning show. It's quite a mixed lot. We have the guitarist and one of the founding members of my absolute favorite band ever, Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Steve Katz is with us, and he visited to talk about a new documentary, Whatever Happened to Blood, Sweat, and Tears. It's an extraordinary story, and it's really about his band being affected by cancel culture because they went on a U.S. State Department-sponsored tour behind the Iron Curtain at the height of their popularity, and the underground press never forgave them. Our second interview is with extraordinarily popular actress Melissa Gilbert, best remembered for her role as Laura in Little House on the Prairie TV series back in the 1970s. And she talks about what it's been like to become a more mature actress, to be married again, and it's really a lovely story, and how they went through the pandemic living out in the woods in a cabin. And finally, we're going to talk to Ralph White, a hero of whom you have probably never heard, and I had not either, until I had the opportunity to read his book, Getting Out of Saigon. And it talks about how he and the organization for which he worked at the time managed to secret an enormous number of children out of Saigon in June of 1975, as the North Vietnamese army was encircling the city and South Vietnam was about to fall to the communists. It's an absolutely fascinating story, and we're really glad we had a chance to talk to Ralph White. So that's what's up for today on the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoy. We start off lighthearted and talking about a documentary. And he wrote a recent book about his adventures as well. Well, today I've got something very special, and it has to do with one of my very favorite bands of all times, Blood, Sweat, and Tears. In June 1970, they had just won the Grammy for Album of the Year, beating the Beatles' Abbey Road album. They had the number one album in the country. It was a gold album, was going platinum. It had three gold singles on that album. And they became the first American rock band to perform behind the Iron Curtain, doing concerts in Yugoslavia, Romania, and Poland on a tour sponsored by the U.S. State Department. The beginning of a very difficult time for Blood, Sweat, and Tears. To talk to us today is one of the founding members of Blood, Sweat, and Tears, was with the band from the very first album, and that is Steve Katz, an incredible guitarist. But we've also got John Scheinfeld, who wrote, produced, and directed the film, pardon the language, What the Hell Happened to Blood, Sweat, and Tears? It's now in movie theaters across North America, and it is the true story of the fallout from doing this tour, what it was like for the band to be on tour, and what it was like for the band after the tour. So we're delighted to welcome to the morning show and to On the Bookshelf, Steve Katz and John Scheinfeld. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. When I was in high school, a trumpet player, my idols were Blood, Sweat, and Tears, because the music that you guys were doing was so different and so exciting and so creative. I think the documentary is remarkable and shows footage that has been hidden ever since the tour, right?
That's right, Dave. One of the things I love about my job is the detective work that we get to do. And to try to track down the best, the most unusual, and the most rare and unseen footage. And in this case, we found footage that was shot when the band went behind the Iron Curtain, first American rock band to perform in those communist countries. So we found all of that film. Most people don't know, for example, Blood, Sweat, and Tears was one of the headliners at the legendary Woodstock Festival because they weren't in the movie.
Right.
Well, we found some of the footage of their performance there. That's also in the film. Any of your listeners that may come to see the film are going to see some really rare and never-before-seen material.
This is really extraordinary for those of us who have been fans of the band all these years to get to see them performing when they're really at the height of their popularity and influence in America. Steve, thank you so much for being with us. I know that you are one of the original members of Blood, Sweat, and Tears on the first album, as well as being with the band through all of this, and you were probably the most politically outspoken member of the band, but even so, going behind the Iron Curtain and seeing communism firsthand was sort of a surprise, right?
Yeah, it was a surprise. I really didn't want to go on this trip because of my politics. I didn't want to represent the Nixon administration, especially during the war years. But you know, I was part of a band, so that was my job. So I went on the trip, and boy, did it change my perspective, because the kids or the people that saw us just flipped. They just loved it. And I realized, wow, we're bringing these people our music, and they're loving it. They don't get the opportunity to see this. They don't get to see, like in Romania, to see a rock and roll band.
Right.
I mean, they weren't, you know, I had a guy, a waiter, come over to me and whisper in my ear, if I give you my address, can you send me a Led Zeppelin album? It was really incredible to, actually when I look back on it, and one thing this movie did was awaken so many memories, and I look back on it, it was making these people happy,
yeah.
Really, really happy. Thousands of people behind the Iron Curtain, because they were behind the Iron Curtain, not because they just loved our music, but because they saw something that they couldn't be a part of.
Right.
And we gave them that, and that felt great. And to this day, I feel happy about that.
One of the things I like about the documentary is that they give all of the members of the band, everybody in the band is alive except for Lou Soloff, tragically, who died in 2015. But everybody gets a chance to talk about what it was like to be there. And one of the things that I never knew, and that I would imagine most people would not know until I saw the documentary, is that essentially your manager at the time kind of worked a deal with the State Department to keep David Clayton Thomas with kind of a permanent green card so he could continue to be with the band, and sort of kind of coerce you guys into saying, hey, you'll do this tour, won't you fellas?
Yeah. In retrospect, I think that we should have said no and played hardball with the Justice Department, because the propaganda that would have come out of that, or the information that would have come out of that, was that would have been that, oh, they kicked our lead singer out, you know, which wouldn't make the government look very good.
Right.
And I was willing to do that, but this deal was made between our manager and the Justice Department, and it was too late. We couldn't say anything. We got killed for it. That's what the film is about, and the film is a thriller, really.
And I remember when you came back, and just being a kid, I thought, wow, this is exciting. I'm really happy for them, and wow. And the third album came out, and it said, wow, this is incredible stuff. What I didn't realize is that when you guys came back, you were under attack from the right and from the left. The right because you went to a communist country, the left because you went to a communist country for the United States.
I mean, somebody just brought up in an interview that it was almost like the Vietnam veterans coming home, you know, like caught in the middle. And in our sense, we were caught in the middle also.
Right. There's a quote from the executive producer, James Sears Bryant, that you guys were early victims of cancel culture. I think that really, that's a great way of defining it. The hip press was really angry at you, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. Really angry. And it really broke my heart, actually. John, you can talk more about the cancel culture thing, because what John did was, he's a great detective, is a great filmmaker, and a great storyteller. He puts that, he articulates it so beautifully in the film. One of the great things about this film, John.
Yeah.
You know, Dave, I think, thank you, Steve. I think one of the interesting things was we tracked down a guy named David Felton, who wrote an article for Rolling Stone that really was one of the lead articles that started this destruction of the band, if you will, from the point of view of the left-wing media.
Right.
And we tracked him down, and he's a lovely, lovely man, articulate man, who was looked back at this article. First of all, he said he had forgotten about this article. Then when he read it, and we caught him on camera saying it, he said, you know, yeah, that kind of sounds like me. Very smarmy, very snarky. And he really regretted what he did. And I think that's an interesting thing in terms of cancel culture, that you get stuck in the moment of something and there's no real time to step back and think about it.
Right.
And I think what we see, Dave, often is that there are a lot of parallels between what's going on in the country now in 2023 and what was going on in America in 1970. Some of the specifics were different, but there are a number of parallels, including the emergence of cancel culture, including, you know, we were sitting in the editing room and we were looking at footage of Russian tanks rolling into Czechoslovakia in 1968 because they were challenging the Russian government.
Right.
And we couldn't help but think of Russian tanks rolling into Ukraine because they were challenging Putin. And I think, you know, what Steve and his bandmates discovered is that living under authoritarian regimes like Putin and like Russia, no great thing, nothing that we really want to be doing. And I think sometimes we forget about that in the heat of political arguments these days. But going back to another point, I think your listeners don't even necessarily need to know who Blood, Sweat, and Tears were, don't necessarily need to know those great records that they made. It's just such a fascinating story with resonance to things that are going on today that I think your listeners are going to find this a really interesting, interesting film.
Absolutely. Gentlemen, thank you so much. We could talk for a half an hour anyway because I enjoyed the band so much, still love playing your records, and enjoyed the documentary so much, this footage that gets smuggled out from behind the Iron Curtain. That's a story in of itself. So thank you very much for making time to talk to me today. And I feel like our listeners are going to want to see this documentary and enjoy it and see it for the cautionary tale it can be, too. So thank you both very much for visiting with me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And to let you know a little bit more about our guest today, John Schneinenfeld wrote, produced, and directed The Happy Days of Gary Marshall, as well as Herb Albert Is, Sergio Mendez in The Key of Joy, Chasing Train, the John Coltrane documentary, This Is Hope, with Billy Crystal speaking the words of Bob Hope, The U.S. versus John Lennon, and Who is Harry Nilsson, as why is everybody talking about him? Steve Catt started on the road professionally when he was 15. His groups include the Even Dozen Jug Band, with future stars like Maria Muldaur and John Sebastian, the Danny Kalb Quartet, the Blues Project, and of course Blood, Sweat, and Tears, the original group, which put out the album Child is Father to the Man, and then the reorganized group with the lineup that was the most successful, won 3 Grammys, voted Best Band by the Playboy Jazz and Pop poll 2 years in a row, won 3 major Downbeat Awards, just to list a few of them. Been really a great pleasure for us to get a chance to hear what happened to the group and about this new documentary that explains it all in great detail. Steve Katz also wrote Blood, Sweat, and My Rock and Roll Years. Is Steve Katz a Rock Star? A memoir by Steve Katz, founding member of Blood, Sweat, and Tears from Lions Press. We're talking today to Melissa Gilbert, best known as Half Pint, Laura Ingalls in Little House on the Prairie, but so many other things. We're delighted to have a chance to talk to her today about her new book, Back to the Prairie, A Home Remade, A Life Rediscovered from Gallery Books. Hi, it's wonderful to get a chance to talk to you. My wife and I have been fans of yours since you were very young. It's so nice to get to talk to you, and I enjoyed your book very much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
I suppose I would be remiss if I did not say thank you for the wonderful body of work that you have done as an actor through the years. Of course, Little House on the Prairie. But I also remember when you did the remake, the story of Helen Keller with Patty Duke. And I thought that was a really wonderful thing. Your new book, Back to the Prairie, A Home Remade, A Life Rediscovered, picks up your life after you had some changes. Some of them were tough and some of them were lovely, including your marriage to Timothy Busfield. And you share how your life has changed since you got married and what you guys have done differently. Have people been surprised to find out that you guys ended up moving out to a lovely rural area and living this kind of idyllic seeming life that's a lot of work?
You know what? I don't think anyone was surprised, which is interesting. I think everyone fully expected that this is where we would end up. Because when we told people this is what we wanted to do and this is where we were going, everybody went, of course. So it just seemed, you know, Tim and I as a couple, it's always been about what comes to us naturally. Mm-hmm. And this is the life that comes to us most naturally. And it was really solidified, as I wrote in the book, during the pandemic when we were locked down up here at this place that we had just renovated, was just made ready for us. And we decided to grow our own food and to get chickens and do all of these things that we'd always wanted to do but never had the time to do.
Right.
So though the pandemic was a horrible, tragic time for so many people around the world, there were little silver linings, and this was the silver lining for us.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we notice the most around here, this is a fairly small town, a lot of people in our outlying areas work on farms, live on farms, is that people had more time with each other, and people had more time with their kids. And those were silver linings into this weird cloud of the pandemic. One of the things that you guys did was really connect with nature, didn't you? You kind of got used to living in the vicinity of a bear. That's a pretty interesting story.
Yes. I mean, there's everything up here. And you know, the amazing thing about nature, when you live in nature, is she's always trying to take back what you have.
Right.
So it's her place. So we have bears, we have foxes, we have eagles and hawks, and we have porcupines and raccoons and squirrels and fisher cats and rattlesnakes. And it's, you know, we've had to navigate, negotiate a life with nature on nature's terms a great deal. And that's what we've created up here. And it really is, it's pretty heavenly, actually.
It's really a lovely story, and you do a wonderful job in making us feel like part of your family as you're telling us about all these adventures, some of them a little scarier than others. There was one thing that happened. You had a serious spinal injury. They tried to fix it, and you had to have it refixed, and that was all happening during the COVID time too, right?
Yes, yes. I've had repeated spinal injuries a lot, and I'd had a spinal fusion again in 2015 that didn't, that failed, and the hardware was coming out. And so I had to get my neck fixed again. And the only way I was going to do it was to go to the surgeon that I worked with previously in Southern California. And it was determined that I had to go during the pandemic. And so I flew cross country during COVID and had the surgery by myself, but mind you, because Tim was here in New York City working on the first television series to come back after the pandemic was sort of winding down-ish. And so I flew there and back by myself, but had the surgery, and I've had no pain since, and it's been an absolute miracle. I have an artificial disc, and I highly recommend if anyone is having disc issues and has to have surgery that they get an artificial disc over a fusion any day.
Wow. I'm so glad to hear that everything turned out so well for you. I know it's a weird thing that people you've never met all around the country kind of think of you as that little girl that we all fell in love with on Little House on the Prairie all those years ago. There is sort of that feeling among the people that have been your fans that we care about you and we want you to be happy and we want you to be healthy. And so that was an encouraging thing to hear that, hey, we could fix this. You guys are still working in the business, but it's different now, isn't it? There's not this feeling that if we don't get the next part, that then our life is going to be over as we know it.
Yeah, well, that's me for sure. My husband works way more than I do because he also directs. And we're actually waiting to hear when we're going to travel to Albuquerque because he's going to be executive producing and directing a series called The Cleaning Lady for Fox. And so, you know, that constantly happens, and I'm always doing plays and things and acting all over the place in television and movies as well. But it's not, I don't feel as ambitious about this. Right now, the majority of my time is taken up by this lifestyle line I launched last year called Modern Prairie. And, you know, we launched our app. It's available on the App Store, and it is, it's a community where maturing women can gather to share and support one another through all of this stuff as we age gratefully through life. And there's a retail component to it, and we have wonderful products all made by women. And my partner, Nicole Hazy, is just the genius who put this all together. And so that's where my passion is right now, Modern Prairie.
Well, that is very cool. And once again, I know your time is short and that you need to go, but please tell your husband a happy birthday. I know his birthday's coming up Monday. I hope it's a great one for him. And thank you so much for spending time with us and all of the other radio folks across America that you've been talking to today. We appreciate you, and we're happy that you're happy and look forward to more wonderful things from you.
Thank you so much. That's very sweet, very generous, and I would gladly talk to you again anytime. You take care.
All right, you too. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We've been privileged today to talk to Melissa Gilbert, actress that we've known since she was a child, and she is now living in the woods with her husband and loving it. Her new book, Back to the Prairie, A Home Remade, A Life Rediscovered. It's from Gallery Books. As we approach the 48th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, we have an extraordinary story to tell. This is a civilian story, the story of a 27-year-old American banker named Ralph White, who had been serving Chase Manhattan Bank in Bangkok and was asked early in April to transfer to Saigon with one particular task in mind. His new book is Getting Out of Saigon. It's from Simon & Schuster. We're delighted to welcome to WTBF Ralph White.
Hi, Dave. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm looking forward to talking about my book. I had worked in Vietnam. My first job out of college was with American Express, and they sent me into the Central Highlands of Vietnam during the war to run a bank on a military base. I was only 22 at the time, so I had a little Vietnamese experience. 4 years later, I was working for the Chase Manhattan Bank, and I came out of the training program in New York, and if you did well in the program, they asked you where you wanted to go. And if you did badly in the program, they told you where you were going.
Right.
And I said, send me to Bangkok. I'd love to go there. And so I had been in Bangkok for about 2 months, and senior management for the Asia Pacific showed up and asked me if I would take over a Saigon branch. And the reason for that was it was the early days of the fall of Saigon, and our manager in Saigon was Dutch, and he didn't believe that the American embassy would help him in the final days. So Chase wanted somebody who was basically young, single, and expendable to take over the branch.
When you got there, you found out that things were far worse than we had been told on the news media, and yet there were people, such as the ambassador, who seemed totally oblivious to the fact that things were going badly and quickly.
That's absolutely right. Things were worse than I had been led to believe. I think than anybody knew, to be honest. I don't think it was a failure of the bank's management that I wasn't informed, and I don't think anybody knew.
Yeah.
The two things that we hadn't really considered was, you know, we knew that the northern provinces had fallen to enemy troops. The North Vietnamese had flooded over the demilitarized zone and had overrun Pleiku, where I'd worked for American Express. That was in enemy hands by the time I showed up 4 years later. What we didn't know, what I didn't know, was that enemy troops were in Xuan Loc, just 40 miles outside Saigon, and that if Xuan Loc fell, there would be no military buffer between the enemy and us. The second thing I discovered that didn't really conform to my expectations was I understood that the U.S. Embassy was going to help us, help Chase close the branch and evacuate the staff. My first meetings were with Ambassador Martin and Deputy Chief of Mission Wolfgang Lehman, and they said, no, we're not going to help you get out. We're not going to help your Vietnamese get out. Stop talking about closing the branch. That's way premature, and it would be illegal for us to help you get Vietnamese out. So stop talking about that too. So there I was, April 14, with 2 more weeks before the fall of Saigon, and I had enemy troops 40 miles away, and the embassy telling me to go to hell.
And how many employees did you have that you needed to evacuate from Saigon?
You know, that's interesting. I at the time, I didn't know. I didn't know how many employees I had. It turns out there were 50-something. Chase instructed me. My mandate was to get out the 4 senior Vietnamese officers, banking officers. And I'd sat down with them, and I knew them. I knew that they had families. That would have been a small group to get on a commercial flight. Mm-hmm. I could have gotten them out pretty easily. If I could get more out than just those 4, then I would take out the department heads. There might have been 10 or so department heads, and I would try to get them and their wives or husbands and children. I wasn't allowed to take out parents or nephews or nieces or brothers and sisters, just employees. But when I got there, the employees told me that they believed that they would be shot and killed if they were left behind because they'd worked for an American bank.
Right.
would be considered enemy troops. And so I had to get all of them out. It took me several days before I realized that included 113 people. When I heard that number, I thought, oh my God, how am I going to get any of them out, let alone 113?
Right, and it's not like you could just book a flight. Everybody's trying to get out. One of the most interesting characters becomes a central character in all of this is a teenage woman that you met at church and noticed her there, and you guys struck up a friendship, and she was of a considerable amount of help to you, wasn't she?
She was. I was approached at the church was the Basilica of Notre Dame in Saigon. It's right in District 1. Most tourists stop off there, and it's still there. And a young woman who turned out to be 17 approached me, and her name was Nya, and she was a prostitute, and she was a sex worker, and she was plying her trade. She was trying to, she tried to recruit me into her plans. I said, look, I don't do that, but what I'll do is I'll pay you to not have sex and to help me out, be my assistant, be a translator. I ended up recruiting her to help me out that way.
It is really a remarkable story, and there were all sorts of alternate plans that you tried and that fell through. There, you had experience as a pilot, so at one point you thought, well, maybe I could get an airplane, and then you found out how many people you needed to get on the airplane and realized even if I could get an airplane, I couldn't get one that big, right?
You know, I like talking to people who have a mastery of the details of the book, and you're doing a great job, Dave.
Oh, thank you.
I did have a pilot's license. I'd flown Pipers and Cessnas, just two-seaters and four-seaters. I'd never flown an airliner. I had no business even thinking that I could. But when I was looking at contingency plans to get my people out illicitly, I thought, well, maybe I could steal a DC-3 and get at least some of my people out that way. Wow. I also have spent a lot of time out on the ocean in salt water, and I'm pretty competent with boat handling. So I thought maybe I could steal a rice ship and get them down the Saigon River that way. And I explored that as an option. I carried $25,000 in cash in case I had to bribe somebody. Carried a 38 caliber revolver in case $25,000 in cash wasn't enough. I had a lot of contingency plans. I ended up not needing to do any of them. I didn't steal a plane. I didn't steal a ship. I didn't bribe anybody. I didn't shoot anybody. I ended up discovering that there was a clandestine program right on behind the ambassador's back inside the embassy to help at-risk Vietnamese get out. And the clandestine program was run by some mid-ranking Foreign Service officers who I give a big shout-out to in the book. Yes. They're the real heroes.
Ralph, it is an extraordinary story. His book is Getting Out of Saigon, How a 27-Year-Old American Banker Saved 113 Vietnamese Civilians. It's from Simon & Schuster. Ralph, thank you very much for the chance to read your book and to get a chance to talk to you. Yeah, you have leapt to the top of my heroes I have met in my life, my friend.
David, you're very, very kind to say so. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time, sir. We've been talking to Ralph White, the author of Getting Out of Saigon, How a 27-Year-Old American Banker Saved 113 Vietnamese Civilians. So those are our guests today. A legendary guitarist, Steve Katz, legendary actress and author, Melissa Gilbert, and a hero named Ralph White. You've never met before, but now you won't forget him. Thanks so much for joining us on The Bookshelf. See you next time right here on your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com and your favorite radio station. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.